Howdy, y'all. Welcome to Components Live. I'm Ren, product marketer at Heretto and your podcast MC.
I'm Patrick, CEO here at Heretto.
And I'm Jared, lead solutions consultant.
Thanks for joining us on our weekly conversation about componentized and structured content. Hope you enjoy this 15 or so minutes of fun talking about everything from data to innovations in AI.
Glad you're catching our live show after it was live and is now a podcast. If you want to join the live show, we stream every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern on LinkedIn and YouTube, but you can always find the recording on your favorite podcast app. All right, let's get into it.
Hello, everyone. Happy Friday. Welcome to Components Live. This is your Friday content rundown to wind down the work week. And the guys have already had a pretty heated debate before we jumped on here. So I'm going to go ahead and hand it right over to them and let them get into it.
All right. So we found an article that is a little controversial. It's based on a study. And we have been debating how we feel about the findings of this article. So again, article is going to be in the show notes, but it is the name of the article is study finds 268% higher failure rates for agile software projects. So the study that the article cites is not perfect by any means. Highlights are conducted recently over a short period of time. It seems like it was probably largely just a questionnaire interviewing developers. Claims to have interviewed 600 software engineers, which are split between the UK and the US, 250 UK, 350 US. It does seem like the people who conducted this study had an opinion going into it. So there's probably some influence on that. I'm not sure that how much that negates the findings in general. But basically what it comes out saying is that a lot of these teams experienced circumstances where Agile Manifesto, working, their quotes, working software over comprehensive documentation prevented these teams from getting the specifications in place that ensured the success. That's kind of the highlight of the article. So the debate on that is that actually agile, or is that a misinterpretation of agile? And is the study extrapolating something that it shouldn't have?
I think this study is dubious, especially with the number. I think there's like 26 million, software engineers in the world. So 600, I could throw a rock and hit 600.
But a sip tastes like the soup.
Well, I think the other part of this is like, Agile is a philosophy and almost nobody actually implements Agile to the actual spec or whatnot.
Sure.
And I was trying to find a little bit more information about like what this book that was paired with the study was kind of indicating and that you should do differently. And so one of the things was, requirements are not being set up front in Agile. And maybe you could take that as people are using Agile to say, well, we're just going to figure it out along the way. And the working software over comprehensive documentation part, I don't think that's not the intention of that. Like if you don't know what you're building, then you're going to fail at it. You're either going to fail to deliver it on time or by the time it needs to be delivered, it's not going to be what you need. So in my experience, Agile is saying, take a minimalist approach to this, like recognize that there are unknowns and there's unknown unknowns and those things. If you try to figure out, if you try to make requirements for those too early, you're gonna influence what you're building in a negative way. But it doesn't mean don't create requirements. Like you should create requirements for things that you have the most confidence in, and then understand that there are gonna be things that are gonna change those requirements in the future, and you have to adapt. It doesn't mean no requirements, no docs. We're gonna wing it, figure it out as we go along. Like I mean, maybe some teams are doing that. Not my experience with Agile.
So as you say that, I think the reality is a lot of teams are kind of doing that. I think that there is, so I know that I've experienced other people that I've talked to them and like talked to them about Agile and stuff like that. There's a version of the purism where like they really just don't believe in documentation, specifications, like documentation anywhere in the process. Like they really believe in like build something, see if it works, change it, and like just continue on the cycle. Like it's very much like a build and user test cycle that produces outcomes. And I'm not sure what percentage of teams doing Agile like view the philosophy in that manner, but I don't think you can say that it's insignificant. Like I think that is a portion of the community that does it that way.
I'm not indicating that doesn't exist. I mean, early on, that's what we did that because we didn't really have project management, right? It was like,
sure.
It was a couple of people in a small office years ago. Right. But like we've realized that that's not the best approach and that there's certainly a spectrum to this. And being somewhere in the middle of the spectrum, and I put the spectrum between like what you're talking about, like total chaos agile, mm-hmm. and waterfall, which is where you're trying to plan out every week, every sprint of what you're going to do until the end. That's the spectrum for me. And I think that being somewhere in the middle is where competent and successful software teams end up.
So this brings us to one of the things that we've talked about a little bit over the years that, and we've also implemented several times over the years, which is something that we've called docs first development, which is, I have always thought is a really interesting way of doing development, but fundamentally what it is that you build the actual user docs with the mocks ahead of implementation. And you do that still ideally in an iterative fashion, so agile or whatever you want to call it. But like you go and you say, we're going to describe very specifically how the end result is going to interact for the user, what it's going to look like to some fidelity. Obviously, it doesn't have to be pixel perfect if you don't want it to be. Before we actually go and we write any code, because the awareness in this is that when you're figuring out like what someone really wants something to do, a deep explanation of it is so much less expensive than a throwaway prototype. And I wonder like how you think about that when you put it in the context of a study like this.
So I think like anything, it's a trade-off. And what you're doing with Docs First Development is you're trading increased resources and involvement through the entire process versus mm-hmm. a lot of resources involved at the end of the process. And certainly that trade-off can be really good for some teams because you're getting extra QA from the information development team because they're writing these docs as things are changing, as they're talking to engineers, and they're going, wait a minute, does this make sense? Like we just said 2 weeks ago that the steps should be A, B, and C, and now we're changing it from, alarms are going off, and that's mm-hmm. really useful. And then the other thing is you are making sure that when you get down to deadline for releasing the software, that there isn't this huge rush to get all the documentation at the end. Because when you're rushing, you don't produce as much documentation. Your documentation isn't as high quality. There might be mistakes in it. So I think that those are the main benefits. Will that make, outside of the QA aspect, will that extra documentation make the software development process go more smoothly and hit timelines better? I don't know about that.
I mean, it's a different form of communication, right? So I think one of the problems that, I mean, even we see is that the specifications that we write for things that we're building, like you read it and I read it, and we both walk away thinking something differently because it's not a narrative. It's very, like, it's similar to like how Amazon and Bezos really dictate that everything is written around a narrative. Like they tell a story about how something should work, how it should be, like why it can be better, those types of things. And so where I think that there's still a lot of room to improve in terms of the overall like product development process that could involve, you know, bringing technical content resources and content developers way forward in the process is being able to build a little bit more of like an actual like content-based narrative that brings people through the process of like, what is this thing going to do? Why is it going to do it? Like, where are the connections between the steps that you may not see in some of the just the general specifications? And I know that we actually haven't done this recently. So like we're not eating our own dog food on this. But we did do this on several projects. I want to say this was like, we did it for a couple of years. And we did that on a number of projects. I can't remember if it was our assignment system or if it was part of the, I think we did it with, I can't remember, but there was a couple of different systems that we did it with. And I remember those actually went quite smoothly. And I can't remember why it is we stopped doing it.
Yeah, I think, I mean, one of the things is that it's, that information is meant for different audiences. So that's one of the things, like the requirements that that product creates, the user stories, all that kind of information, that can't really be represented the same way inside something that you intend to be end user documentation. So one of the things that you get is that you get two different outputs meant for two different purposes that have to be different, and you have to keep them in sync. And that creates a lot of time and involvement. And I think for the size of the team that we are, that was kind of maybe a neutral investment for us. I think some of those projects went well. Some of them, I don't think went super well. I mean, certainly one of the really nice benefits of this is that if you have requirements, other things that you want customers to validate, it's much easier to have customers to validate documentation than to validate raw user stories and requirements and things like that, because now they're actually looking at the documentation like they would if they were actually using the feature. It's a lot easier to understand. So I think that's super, super valuable. But I also think that, you know, for us, the size of the team that we have, not as huge of a multiplier as I expected. And that's kind of why I don't think we did it. We continue to do it. Although I'd be willing to do it again because our team has grown since the last time we did it. It's like more than doubled in size. So probably worth trying it again. But even in the past, it was just kind of too small of a team. If you have a larger team, you could see a multiplier of the benefits for sure.
Yeah, I think just having everybody on the same page, you know, everybody being, you know, marketing, the customer, developers, product, like really like nailing that down, not in terms of like exactly every feature, but like intention of flow, intention of behavior, like all of that kind of stuff before the code is actually written, like is really valuable, which is why I actually went and tried to figure out where we had done this in the past, because I remembered thinking that it went really well on a couple of bigger things we were implementing. And I wasn't able to dig that up in the like 20 minutes I had before this. So
maybe you can like create a post later and tell people more about it if you find it, if you figure it out. Yeah. Okay, cool. So I have a couple of hot topics that I want to get to. So I'm cutting you off. You're officially over. First one is NVIDIA has had a really big week. They have officially surpassed Apple and their new value is $3 trillion. But in the same week, the antitrust group within the government has decided to investigate them and Microsoft and OpenAI because they look like they might be violating some antitrust laws.
Oh, boy. So you want to start with that one? I have feelings on the raw economics of it, but the antitrust part, why don't you take a stab there?
Yeah, I don't have super strong feelings on the raw economics of it. I mean, I think everyone kind of saw that coming within, you know, maybe 5 years ago, not really, but with the combination of cryptocurrencies and now AI, yeah, it's unsurprising to me. But the antitrust thing is really interesting. I mean, what are your thoughts on that, Patrick?
On the antitrust part or the economic part? The antitrust part, I think they're going to have a really hard time with that because generally speaking, this technology is like highly distributed. Like there's tons and tons and tons of models everywhere. And even though like there's been obviously a lot of collaboration, or I guess they're going to try to prove collusion between these large organizations to, you know, be on the edge of this. At the end of the day, like people can still buy NVIDIA and they can go and they can build their own models. And, you know, Hugging Face has got, you know, what, a bajillion models? Is that the actual number? So I don't really like antitrust on this. I think they're going to have a real hard time. I don't see how they're doing anything that's like distorting market forces, but I don't have all the details. That's just my view on that.
Yeah. It would be nice to see more, more places that you could buy GPUs from that were of the same high quality, although it sounds like this antitrust case is not really about that in particular. But certainly, you know, we're definitely lacking a number of places that you can go and you can get high quality GPUs for a decent cost.
I will say quickly on the economics of it, NVIDIA's valuation is a result of what people hope it is worth in the future. It is not a result of what NVIDIA is actually doing today, and that is how valuations work. So even though they're technically worth more than Apple, that doesn't make them bigger or more profitable or even more impactful. So there's my minor in economics.
Iris Dahl would be very proud of you today, Patrick. Okay, so I actually have two more, so we're going to get to them. There is a Harvard Business Review article that came out today that I thought was really interesting. And I'm going to read the tagline because I want to get it right. But the author's research of this article found that by providing consumers with information on the environmental and social impact of home deliveries, so think Amazon Prime, 2-day, all of that, omnichannel retailers could capture $100 billion worth of market share from Amazon just because they're being notified of the economic impact of their home deliveries.
What is an omnichannel deliverer?
Yeah, so basically they're saying that like people like Target, who offers like home delivery, but they also do pickup. The pickup market is like a really big one that could capture a bunch of Amazon dollars just because people are very aware of their social and like ecological impact. I thought that was interesting. Okay. Like a simple notification could change the buyer behavior.
Content changes the world. It always does.
It totally does.
So, but like, here's what I want to know about that. This is a non-content point on that. So if I, you know, click on this and it says pickup, is it going to tell me how much carbon dioxide I'm putting into the atmosphere by driving to go get it?
Definitely not.
Okay. So then it's not fair. So then like, you're not giving me a complete set of information.
Actually, I don't know that 100% for sure. That might be like further down in the article. Right. I'll follow up That's in the comments and let everyone know. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting. And it's like, everyone's trying to find a way to beat Amazon. And I thought that that was a very unique perspective for it. Now we'll see how that changes as Amazon rolls out their EVs, but still, interesting. Now, the last one I just thought was really cute, and I wanted to end it on a good note. And I know that Casey is really into 3D printing. Maybe he'll show off some of his 3D prints at some point. But there was the youngest person, a 5-year-old boy, who got a bionic arm. He got a hero arm, which is the shape of Iron Man's arm, from Open Bionics. And it's fully functional. He can use the fingers and everything. And he was like so stoked about it. And it's adorable. It was on BBC News. I will share that. So cute.
That's super cool. I've seen those before and it's incredible.
Yeah. So he's the youngest person to ever receive it. And they said that he put it on and he couldn't wait to get back to school to show all his friends his new bionic hero arm. And he chose Iron Man.
Wow. And so for our viewers' enjoyment, Casey has built bionic Halloween decorations. So how hard do you think an arm is to build, Casey? You could whip one of those up in your 3D printers?
I could make a very poorly functioning one for sure.
I mean, the fact that it would function at all is absolutely wild. So you win every single time.
I think Casey needs to post his AI driven bionic Halloween decoration to the show notes somewhere.
I agree. I'm going to make sure that happens. And so Casey can share that because we've all seen it and it's amazing. And then maybe we can talk more about it next week. But we are officially over time. So I'm going to go ahead and end it here. But thank you so much for sticking around for our hot topics. And we will see you next week.